Welcome everyone to the third installment of Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thank you for joining Productivity Book Group on a live call or on the podcast. We'll be discussing chapters 7 through 10, which covers organizing, setting up the right buckets, reviewing, which is keeping your system functional, doing, making the best actions, and getting projects under control, which is chapter 10. We'll cover as much as we can, so I'll jump right into chapter 7 with a question to start us off. For everyone, you know, just jump in if you have any thoughts as I ask any of these sort of prompting questions. So David Allen writes that it's critical that all of these categories, that is the projects list, project support material, calendar, next actions list, waiting for list, the reference and someday maybe list, which he lists sort of at the beginning of chapter 8, be kept pristinely distinct from one another. They each represent a discrete type of agreement we make with ourselves, end quote. How much do you adhere to these sort of hard edges that David Allen demands? I'm sort of curious what people think. Who wants to jump in?
This is Robert. I can.
Hey, Robert. How's it going?
Okay. I will say that I do not. I have a blurry line going from one to another. And that's one of the reasons I like to attend your meetup meetings, and I like to reinforce all the values that the system advocates. But I find it... It's just too difficult for me to distinguish each one as a separate unit.
Right. I mean, for me especially, I find myself in a place where my project list is definitely defined distinctly. My project support material is something that's a little bit more malleable for me, something that sort of blends from one tool to the next, and I think that's probably because I play around with so much technology on a regular basis in my professional world that I end up using so many different tools for project support. My calendar is definitely a hard edge. It has a distinct line, and I adhere almost explicitly to the David Allen rules of the three reasons for putting anything in your calendar. My next actions list is a pretty hard edge. My waiting floors are a little bit softer, but definitely I know where they begin and end. Reference is definitely something that I have control on in my someday maybe list, because I have those distinctly as separate items. Some days and maybe are definitely hard edges. So my second question is that it's sort of a statement sort of on this whole point that I like that David talks about the idea that lists and folders for reference and support materials are really all you need in order to do GTD, and that it's not about the list, but about what you put on them that make them functional. And he talks about people consistently putting sort of incomplete on their list. And I was curious about folks' processes. How do you go through the process of really defining what goes on to your list and into your folders? So anyone thoughts?
Ray, it's Joseph here. I'm 646. And your question was defining, how do I define what's in my lists and my folders? Is that correct?
Yeah. How do you define the two of them? I mean, it's sort of there's a blend between putting things that are action reminders on a list, obviously, or projects on a list, and those things that go into folders. How do you define them?
I probably don't define them too well. I'd say I definitely have vanilla folders where I use to collect information, things that are to review at some point in the future. Then I have lists, which are for the most part Google Docs that pertain to different projects and things I collect. So I don't know if I separate them as well as I could, I'd say. But I would say that the folders are more for long-term things I need to put out of my mind. And the list are the things that are kind of on the forefront of things that I need to manage and prioritize one by one. And hence, you know, the list is something that I continually, when I'm working on that project, or that item, I reorganize and so forth, because it's more of a matter of collecting things and prioritizing things versus having articles and other items that I put away into a folder, if that makes sense. That's how I use it. And I'm not sure if that's in the context of GTD, but that's just my answer to that question.
Right. And so just to clarify, so do you feel like your folders then sometimes are taking the place of sort of someday maybe, or some days and maybes, is it more project support, or both?
Exactly. It's a bit of both, I'd say. It's a bit of both, and more for project support, I'd say.
Okay, right.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, you had a thought?
Thanks for clarifying.
Sure, absolutely. Mark?
Yeah, I was wondering, I've never really thought about like folders versus items. Could you give me an example maybe of where you guys run into that issue?
Yeah, sure. So some people manage their entire system based on folders being the project and, say, a sheet of paper or an index card representing their next action. So if I were really attempting to be very hard-edged about what things are actions and which things are projects, I would literally write on my project folder my outcome, my envisioned outcome is. And then in my folder, I would have a sheet of paper or some kind of series of index cards listing the next couple of next actions that are associated with that particular folder. And so as I completed the actions, I might throw away the index cards or mark them complete or something like that, and therefore have that. But that's just one example of many different ways in which people use some kind of container, whether that's a list with next action items on it, you know, written in consecutive chronological or random order, and or using physical containers for holding next actions and or even projects within the context of another category.
Okay. That definitely makes sense. I guess I just kind of I don't really view it like that because I don't use the physical folders, but it's key
so
for
what,
me.
What do you do? I'm curious.
Well, basically, I'll have a project. We're talking about projects and next actions and in my terminology, I guess. And basically, I'll have a project and I'll just start off and I will try as good as I can to clarify the outcome. And then I may add some purpose if that's necessary, and then I'll basically just have a section where I brainstorm. And when I actually don't do as well as I should are the times when I just let that brainstorming become a mixture of actions and non-actionable material. But when I'm actually on top of it on the projects that I feel like I have a really good hold of, which I'm always working towards, is when I always go through and gather the actionable materials from that brainstorm material so it doesn't become stale.
That makes a lot of sense.
Is that
makes a lot of sense.
We on the same page?
Absolutely. That's great.
Okay.
And so
cool.
Sort of in that same vein, David defines, quote, unquote, a list as, quote, nothing more than a grouping of items with some similar characteristics, end quote. So outside of a calendar, I sometimes have a difficulty thinking, I think, sort of your confusion, Mark, about having a project folder with next actions in it, because that's not how I've ever done my system, but I know that some people do. And I'm sort of curious about other folks on the line, if you use any unique ways to track items that are not on a traditional list. I know that for a while I was using an Excel spreadsheet as my entire GTD management system, but I think that still qualifies as a list or a series of lists.
What I use is Google Docs and I use Mind Maps. And with MindJet, I just create a mind map and I have a link to the different resources where I know those resources are for that particular item. And that helps me clarify things. And all it is more of an organic list, I'd say. But it allows me to link things in a pretty effective way or resources or put imagery in certain ways that when it comes to working on that or growing it, allows me to really get a full grasp on it more easily and readily than a typical static linear list. That's it.
Absolutely, and so it's sort of a visual map as opposed to having lists.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. So there are these organizing contexts that David Allen offers at the beginning of Chapter 7 for doing as soon as possible actions. And he has the calls, errands, at office, at home, agendas, read, review, etc. And I'm curious if people have modified those context tags, categories, or whatever you want to call them in your system. If so, why and how? I know that I've modified my context over time, but I'm wondering if people sort of started with his as a base and modified or just went from scratch with your own. So I definitely still use my calls list. I have a calls context within Remember the Mill, and I've never not used that. I think that's always been sort of core to my system. Within Remember the Milk, it has a location-based service that or function that allows me to be able to decide what happens at home or at office or, say, at a grocery store or a department store or some kind of other location where something has to happen. So I tend not to use the at-home and at-work context because those are built into the system, but in essence, I am using them. And I've always used a healthy agendas list, and I manage agendas probably differently than David Allen proffers, but I basically create a unique tag for each individual in my world, and that sits on a master agendas list so that I'm able to, in the context of looking at my agendas list, I can sort of see everything that I need to address with everyone and then filter it down to the individual, because sometimes those overlap. You know, maybe there's a team project and I need to look at several things that I need to talk to people about, and I want to be able to see those in sort of a master view, or just filtering some of those people out, and I can do that within my in the Remember the Milk software. And then I definitely still do at errands, because there are some things that are just things that I need to do out and about, and they're not registered as locations, so to speak, within Remember the Milk. But I know that I have to do that outside the house, and it's not going to happen at home or at work. I'm curious how other people manage those contexts.
Ray, this is Robert again.
Robert?
The one here on the list that I actually do without, I guess unconsciously, not formally, that read and review. I tend to, if I have things that I have to read, but I'm not ready to at that exact moment, then I will put them in a certain file or a certain location, and then I plow through all my reading in one sitting. And what I like about this is that I've been doing it without even knowing that that's actually even part of the GTD system. So I have to admit, I haven't opened this book in a while. I've had the audiobook, so I've been listening to it, but now I'm having it open, and I see the list here. I'm saying that, yeah, that's I do the at calls, I do the errands, and at home I combine, because I work at home, I tend to combine office and home. But the read and review was something that I had forgotten that's part of this, because I kind of automated it for myself.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, you know, it's so funny because David Allen says right at the beginning of the book that so many of these things that you're doing them already. It's just doing them in combination to make it a cohesive system. So
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I use read and review a little differently, because I have a physical book. I have a fairly large library of books that I own. And then, of course, I have digital books now, and I have e-books that I've downloaded onto hard drive, and then I have articles that I pick up online or research studies that I want to read. And so I use Pocket to manage that. And then, of course, if I come across a website, I want to be able to review that website, but it's not for a specific thing. It's just to sort of give an overview of it. So I sort of put together the system where I use SpringPad for managing the websites I'd like to review. I use Pocket for those things that I want to capture in terms of web articles that I'd like to read. And that allows me to be able to tag them also, so I can have a category associated with those. And then I have a specific reading strategy that I have for physical book and digital book that I'm reading. Because I keep in my track, I keep a nonfiction and fiction book in my personal life. I always have one of each of those in my personal life. And then in the work-related realm, I have one in each category of sort of my professional world. So business management, and on the other side, technology. And that allows me to be able to sort of go back and forth between those items as I'm sort of reading. And I know that a lot of people out there sort of talk about the idea that you should only read one book at a time. But in my world, I read so much on a regular basis that, you know, if I have four or five books in my list to read, I'll get through those in that particular week and be moving along. So the speed and fluidity with which I'm moving through material, it makes more sense for me. Other folks?
Ray, you mentioned Pocket. Is it Pocket Informant to use, or is what exactly is the Pocket?
Oh, so Pocket, you can find, I'll put that in the show notes. It's getpocket.com. It used to be called Read It Later, but it's very similar to Instapaper or Readability and those other programs that capture the article or capture the underlying content within the article and takes away all of the web formatting and so forth, so that you can just read it in a separate space. I know that Safari, I believe, Apple Safari has a built-in reading functionality, but since I'm multi-platform, that doesn't really work for me. So yeah, there's a lot of tools out there that do that. But Pocket's amazing. I really can't speak more highly of it. It's everywhere, including the web, the Chrome plugin, where you can just right-click and hit Save to Pocket to any link that you see. It works within my web browser. Pocket walks you through a little process, so you can save it as a bookmark, and then you just click on the bookmark, click Save to Pocket, and then it does the process of saving it into Pocket from even your mobile browser. So really, really intelligent piece of software.
Great. Brilliant. I've used Readability, and this is even more effective. This is great.
I really think you'll like Pocket so much better. And if you can, I don't know if you can export from Readability, but if you can, you can just import it into Pocket as an import function. So you don't have to lose anything. And in general, as a rule of thumb, I do this thing where if it's work-related reading, I will keep it in my Pocket. But if anything is personal reading, like things that I'd like to read, you know, I'll save it today. But if I come back to it at the end of the day and I don't have time to read it, I automatically archive them all and mark them as read and let them go. Because if it wasn't important enough for me to make the time for it, then it's not important enough for me to have to leave it in my system for the day after. And if I want to, it's saved, it's archived, I can look at it any time. But the reality is that to have that flow over to the next day really starts to fog up the gears.
Someone mentioned on a Quantibi's call that they use a different browser for personal and for professional as a means of separating things, and I did that for a while, and it was very useful. Firefox for personal, like hence reading articles online, and Chrome for business-related things, so I can kind of separate that. And so that's something I have done in the past and probably get back into now that I'm reminding myself of it. Thank you.
Yeah, that's really fantastic. Yeah, that came from the 25 Tips for Productivity from Auguste Pinault, his book. And I think you can find that at AugustePinault.com. I'll add that to the show notes also. And, yeah, he promulgates using two browsers, one for personal, one for professional. And, yeah, I actually do as well. I use several browsers but for different contexts, not just personal and professional, but I break them up based on the context of what I'm doing. So, yeah, that's it. So I wanted to talk about tracking. It talks about tracking original items as its own action reminder. Something that I found really helpful but isn't as environmentally friendly per se is that I'll print out really involved emails and attach them to my task list that I print daily also. So I mark up the email in my own handwritten annotations before I outline next actions or projects or responding to that email. And I was curious, in what ways do you folks manage your email workflow? Do you use David's prescribed workflow with the unique folders at action, at waiting for, at project, so on, or something different?
Yeah, I was going to say that for me, this is one of the best thing values that I get from the GTD system, which is just the concept of inbox to zero and being able to file all my emails on a regular basis, and now I'm getting used to doing that in Evernote, putting them into different folders. So, but even when you talk to people who haven't heard of GTD, and you just mention the expression inbox to zero, their faces tend to glow because they realize that's an incredible feat to be able to pull off. So I'm not sure if that's exactly what your question refers to, but that's the best value that I get specifically from GTD.
Yeah, I think a lot of people dream of inbox zero and never really get there. And I'm curious how folks actually do manage that and so on and so forth, because you know I do have weeks like this week, for instance, where you know I'm not at inbox zero, but most weeks I am, and it just keeps things clear for me. It keeps the runway clear. It allows me to be able to manage and process things really well. And of course, I know when my life is sort of, you know, a little overburdened at the moment because my email inbox will not be zero. It's a great indicator for me that there's something awry. It could be a very good thing, you know, that I'm just very busy with work and very engaged in the analog world. But it can also sometimes be that something is awry in the possibly bad way, and I need to fix something. So definitely a positive. Albert, you had a hand up?
Yes, this is Albert. For my emails, I just drag, at work, I have Outlook and OneNote, so I just drag my emails to OneNote as like project support material normally. And I delete the extra threads that I don't need. So like if it's a long thread, I just delete the previous email and just put the new one in the OneNote page.
You keep the latest email with everything historical underneath it and put that into OneNote.
Yes. It's also helpful because they now have limits in business emails mostly for how much email you can store, and the rest is archived, so it's kind of harder to get to. Like in the GTD system, they want you to be able to reach it so that it doesn't hinder you. So basically, I can find it using search in OneNote and also getting the appropriately labeled page in OneNote and just opening the email that I want to see. So that's very helpful. That's at work only, though. For webmail, I do it a little differently.
How do you do it for webmail?
I just process it immediately. Just go straight down. Just put it in my task list I just put in my task list. That's the basic thing. I use Google Tasks, so I just type it in if I need to, or if it's in Gmail, then I just do add to task and just type it in.
Great. Thanks for sharing.
Hey, Ray, I use Active Inbox. I'm not as consistent with it, but when I am consistent with it, I find it very useful. It's a good extension on Chrome, and it's pretty great. I have been having some breakdowns as far as dealing with massive emails, and I think Inbox Zero is a great solution. The thing I do, I have a spreadsheet that I have. It's like an accountability spreadsheet. I track different areas of my life, and like each column is a day of the week. And I have about 7 people in my life who have access to the spreadsheet, and they can kind of log in and track it my entire month. And one thing on that list is kind of getting my inbox to zero or managing that. And I'm able to track my performance in other areas when I am able to get to that. I'm having a breakdown with that. It may be something that I outsource in the future, you know, find an assistant or such. I don't know if that's the best solution for that. You did mention that there was an organization that does that, or a product, in a meeting 2 months ago.
That was Gmail Valet. And Gmail Valet is a startup that there are real live humans who gain access to your Gmail account, and they actually find the tasks that are in your inbox and process them for you. So they remove the email and move it into a task so that it's no longer an email but a task. I think it's currently free. It's currently completely free to use. So
I may tap into that because this is of everything in the GT system, is the one thing that I haven't built a muscle around that's consistent on a regular basis. I have these great tools, Active Inbox and such, and they're great, but still I'm staring at a inbox with quite a few thousand emails that need to get managed.
Yeah, I'm really curious about this idea that you're talking about, having a group of people that have access to your sort of system. And so this is this is your email specifically?
No, it's everything. I can actually read you all the things I'm tracking. And basically, it's Google spreadsheet, and let me go to right now. I track how much I'm generating revenue per day. I track basically about 20 things in my life. It's all, and each column signifies day of the week. And I have that column broken down into currency value and time spent. So I basically track if I did first things first on a given day, the amount of sleep I got the previous night, if I planned my next day the morning of, if I exercised, interval training. Basically, I track about 20 things. But if I cleared out my inbox, spent time on that. Then I basically track, kind of like Ben Franklin, my virtues at the end of my day, like how I adhered by my virtues and my level of fulfillment at the end of each night. So I have about 7.
You can go to 13virtues.com and actually learn about Benjamin Franklin's 13 virtues. That's great.
Cool. I'll check it out. Yeah, thank you. And it just helps me track it and also hold it to account, because these people do text me and they're like, hey, what's going on here? You haven't filled out your spreadsheet, or I see you haven't done first things first, you know, today. And I can see, kind of graphically, I can see how, if I haven't managed something, like if I haven't managed exercise or something, or lack of sleep, how it affects other areas of my life. That's it.
That's fantastic.
Thank you for the
research.
ThirteenVirtues.com.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to sort of think about how I could, I know how I could technically give access to some trusted people in my life, but really how I would feel comfortable, how comfortable I would feel about sharing, you know, sometimes more intimate thoughts and that type of thing. I mean, I don't particularly have anything to hide. I don't really care about it on that level. It's just I'm encouraged because it's accountability and that motivates. I'm nervous to let people down, you know?
I don't have intimate thoughts here. I have links to other Google spreadsheets and each, you know, for each of the items I have, but no one has access to those spreadsheets. I'm just tracking hours. I'll read it down. Hours sleep night prior, it's number one. Number two is, did I eat that my frog? Number three is, that I plan forward? Number four is expanding integrity. Number five is exercise. Number six is managing my environment. Number seven is email reduction daily. Number eight is that I engage with one tribal leader. So one of my goals is to engage with at least one tribal leader per day, someone who manages groups. Did I tithe today? Did I? Another one on my list is did I? and then I also track how much revenue I generated in each of my income sources, my buckets. So basically, I have like a row for each revenue source. Then I also calculate how much revenue I generate per day. And that gets added up at the end of the month and end of the week. So I'm using those formulas in my spreadsheet, so I'm able to calculate that. Beginning of the month, I set a revenue goal. So this started as a revenue tracking spreadsheet, and then I basically added all these other rows when I started realizing that when I didn't manage certain things in my life, how it would have impact that number, that financial number. And I associate currency and revenue as I associate them all together, even though currency, to me, kind of aligns with Keith Ferrazzi's whole idea of currency. You know, like it's not necessarily money, perhaps, but it could be what you put into a relationship. Or, you know, it could be like emotional thing.
Gotcha.
Kind of that whole idea. Sorry to kind of rant about this, but it is this one that works for me that hasn't worked for me the past year. What I've been doing.
Thank you for sharing that. That's great. I hope people can use some of that information in terms of being able to do that. Like I said, I'm going to definitely start thinking about how I could do that in some ways, because I have this team accountability project concept, you know, at teamaccountabilityproject.org, and that's something that really is very interesting that might work into it. But I want to move us along into Chapter 8 and then move on to and so forth. But Chapter 7 sort of ends with David Allen talking about dealing with big projects, sub-projects, and project support material. And this idea of managing those things that are non-actionable data, you know, that could be reference files, someday maybe lists, and using a tickler file as well as checklists. And I'm sort of curious if anyone has any sort of broad thoughts about any of those distinct items, managing big projects, what I call meta projects, mega projects, sub projects, and project support materials, and then, of course, all the other sort of other parts of the organizing system, reference files, someday maybe lists, tickler files. So Chapter 8 is short, but it's a really pivotal chapter. It was funny that Jason Womack was tweeting at me yesterday about how important we should focus on Chapter 8, and it's just this very small chapter. It's only a couple of pages long, and it takes us from a control view to a perspective view of our system. We go from next actions and projects from the runway, and we start looking at things from a higher level perspective. David introduces his first full explanation of the weekly review, and I'm curious what folks' initial thoughts were about the weekly review. Did you do it regularly? Do you do it regularly? Did you struggle? Did it come naturally? What were your experiences with the weekly review?
Joseph here. I do it regularly. When I'm inconsistent with it, there's an impact to my week. And I have my own process with it, kind of a standard operating procedure process of things buckets and things I review, including my someday list and things of that sort that I clear out each week. And beyond that, I actually created a system around it to help others with it. So I have an email that goes out to a group of people each week and amidst my community, and we all take on doing the weekly review. And we all come onto a call on Saturday morning, prior to this one actually, where we kind of share and have the opportunity of completing our week, sharing our wins, magic moments, the challenges, and as a means of taking further completion of that weekly review task on Friday to a level of kind of community, kind of bringing further completion to that to move forward. And then Sunday email goes out to plan the week. And so I built it into a system for myself and then for others, and when I do it, it does make a huge difference in my level of clarity and freedom into my next week.
As a huge fan of accountability, I love that. I like it. Anyone else with regard to the weekly review? What do you do? Do you do it? What are your struggles?
There's Robert again, Ray.
Hey, Robert.
I think you've heard me say at the meetup meetings that this is my favorite part of the GTD system, and I get most value from it. I do it every week. I make sure that I do it consistently, and just like, is it Albert who just spoke before me? Just like he said, if I miss a week, I really feel it. It impacts me because something feels empty, or I feel like things are falling through the cracks, and I snap right into it. And when I hear the way that David Allen says, or the webcast that I would listen to from the subscription, that people have, this is their biggest problem that they have. I don't get it. To me, it's more some of the other aspects. But weekly review, I get my money's worth out of the system just by doing that.
That's really funny. I mean, I think it's really interesting that you do it so consistently, and everyone else really does struggle with it. I know that many people struggle with doing the weekly review, and so I'm sort of curious if you could sort of describe what you do right before the weekly review that gets you to do it so consistently. So I think that those habits that lead up to your weekly review every week, it's probably key insight into what other people probably struggle with. Do you mind sharing that?
Yeah, well, it's just like, again, just like the gentleman before me said, leading up to it, throughout the week's time, things tend to get, they build up one project after another, and then things are thrown in without any preparation. But by the time it comes to doing the weekly review, it's I get order out of this chaos. I sit back. I don't do, and this is one of the things that I had suggested to Nick at our last meetup. When I do the weekly review, I don't do anything else. I don't focus on anything else, even if it triggers something. Oh yeah, I have to work on that. I won't stop the weekly review and work on something else. So I make sure that I get everything in order, all my systems in order, and that gives me so much more control of my life. It's a powerful feeling to be in control, and that's where, again, I would say that, the top value from GTD is, I guess if I look at my natural characteristics, it fits right in with me wanting order and control in my life of things that tend to be in my control. So I'm not sure if that's really making much sense, but yeah, as I say, I look forward to it because it's a chance for me to catch up on everything that might have been sitting in the background that I know needs attention, at least needs an update.
Right, right. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Hey, Mark, you have a thought? Oh, sure. Joseph and then Mark.
Okay. I saw David live, and he kind of put out how important this is. Like, this is like the most important meeting that you can have for yourself each week. And he talked about how he does it with executives. He even has like an emergency tape, yellow tape around their office. So I made it kind of a priority in my life and such. If I can share my process a little bit around that, I take everything, put it in flight mode when I do a weekly review. I put together a set of questions that kind of a base level weekly review that mentioned the whole accountability process where, myself and a buddy getting the call on Friday morning, we kind of go back and forth through these questions, asking each other, and it's on a basic level, it's a minimal it's a minimal week review template. These questions, and if people are curious about that, the questions are at the bottom of 10powerquestions.com, number 10powerquestions.com, and then from having those basic questions answered, it's an easy factor of scheduling a time in the afternoon on Friday to finish the rest of my weekly review, because I've already started it and already have some level of completion. And so that's my process. Putting things in flight mode is essential, and then having the completion call on Saturday where people get to celebrate and set their intentions for the next week. Accountability is a big part of that that makes it happen. That's it.
Oh, absolutely. Mark?
Oh, yes. Ray, I think that some of the best advice that I got from reading this or from David Allen that I've been able to pass on to others is when he talks about until you actually feel the value of the weekly review, it's hard to see the value. And he says just basically to trick yourself into it by forcing yourself to do a few in a row. He doesn't really give this number, but what I like to think about is just force yourself to do three. Just set aside 2 hours and do three in a row. And for me, once I actually see that and I see that value, then I don't have to trick myself into doing it anymore because I know the value and I actually want to get back there.
That's a really great tip. I hope people actually do that. I'd like to move on to chapter 9, which is where David starts to incorporate this concept of the four criteria model of choosing action. So we've moved from the perspective view back down to the control view. We're in our runway sort of model, and we'll get to the 6-level model for reviewing shortly. But the idea is that when you have to choose an action, you are going from the workflow map and you're choosing context, and then time available, then energy available, and then you get to this amorphous thing that's known as priority. And for the prior, 40, 50 years perhaps, we had talked about the idea of prioritizing, ABC, 1, 2, 3, prioritizing. But here David puts us into prioritizing as the very last option in our system. And I'm sort of curious, when you get down to context, time, and availability and energy all being equal, how do you folks on the call prioritize tasks? How do you decide on prioritizing? I know that I have my own prioritization system that I've used for many, many years, and it's a point-based system that always allows for an odd number. And so the way that I do the system is that I look at it from three different perspectives, if you want to call it that. And the three perspectives are, what's in it for me? And I give myself a point system based on that, so say 1, 2, 3. And that's just, is this a low-level benefit to myself? Is this a medium-level benefit to myself? Or this is a really great benefit to myself? And then I look at it from the Merrill-Covey matrix, which was invented by President Dwight D. Eisenhower, but it's the important, urgent, not important, not urgent matrix. And I look at it from that perspective, and that, of course, gives me 4 points. It moves up in terms of order from the most important thing being important, not urgent, to then not important, not urgent. And then I look at it from a perspective of when it's due to someone else. That is, if I owe it to someone else, or then if I want to get it done by a particular amount of time, what's the time frame involved with that particular thing? And so I look at things as soon as possible, near term, which could be a couple of days to a couple of weeks, to the long term, which could be any time. And so then I take those point-based systems, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 1, 2, 3, and calculate a score. And then I do that for everything in the series of things that I could do, all things being equal, time, energy, and context, and make the decision there. So I'm not doing this for every task. I'm only doing it for the things that end up in that very slim, narrow sliver of time when I can do anything, and I can't make a decision on what to do next. I'm curious what other people do. I know mine's a little bit more methodological, but I have to do that or else I get stuck. Well, David has the threefold model for evaluating daily work then. He talks about predefined work, ad hoc work, and then defining your work. Of course, you want to get to feeling confident about the work you've predefined against the things that show up from your boss, spouse, children, parents, friends, so forth in your daily life. And I'm curious, how do you get yourself into a mindset to feel that confidence against all of the options that are available to you and sometimes the challenges that are available to you? Do you have any thoughts for people who might be challenged in having that boss or supervisor comes in and puts that next thing in front of them and feeling challenged to do that thing now, even though they've defined what they were going to do first?
Mark? Yeah, Ray. I think that everybody, has the gift of being involved in, but a good culture where you can communicate about the things that you're working on, the priorities, is invaluable to me. I know that if somebody that I report to comes to me with something and I'm working on something else, just the ability to have a good conversation about the sacrifice that I'm going to have to make if I do work on that item. And I'm, really lucky to work in an environment where that makes sense. And if I do have to put something down, then we've had the conversation and there's no ill will coming for me about doing something else because both parties know the drawbacks and benefits.
That's great. I think every organizational culture should embrace that.
This is Joseph here. And one thing, so I've been doing more consulting recently with organizations where these things do come up, where things kind of get put in my face and so forth. And for me, it's an ongoing thing of being clear about what the result is I'm after, communicating out to the team or the people I'm working with so they're aligned with that, and honoring my core values every moment personally to see if it really is something that fits into that. And, of course, if it's something that's thrown in my face where it's where to move a project forward for example, the company that I'm consulting with, then it's just a matter of recognizing that if there's time to work on that moment, that the manager is aware of the situation, and also if I can leverage components of that. So I'm always looking at ways of leveraging that, leveraging things to make things more efficient and so forth.
Absolutely, absolutely. So moving right along, in Chapter 8, David then brings us to sort of something that most people know iconic regarding GTD, which is the six-level model for reviewing your own work, which I'll just cover briefly so that everybody's sort of on the same page. You have your runway, which is the current action. You then go up to the 10,000-foot level using an airport sort of a plane analogy with altitude. We come up to 10,000 feet, and that's where you're at your current project level. Then we go up to the 20,000-foot level, which is areas of responsibility and what he calls creating an areas of focus list. And he actually notes that it's one of the most important lists that you might have in your system, the areas of focus list. And I think that's really closely related to categories of improvement in Anthony Robbins' terminology, but I'm sure that people can argue that. And then he takes us to 30,000 feet, which is 1 to 2 years, 40,000 feet, which are 3 to 5 year vision, and then 50,000 foot level, which is life goals, life vision, life meaning, purpose. What are your thoughts about the six-level model for reviewing, and specifically about doing what David Allen says, which is to work from the bottom up in creating productive alignment in your life? Almost everyone else says to do it the opposite way, and David sort of throws it on its head figuratively by saying, you know, do this from the meat and potatoes of the work, not from the top down.
This is Joseph here, and I subscribe to both Tony Robbins' approach as well as David's approach, bottom up and top down. And how I work around this is that I have set days where I kind of have the top-down approach, where I kind of work down and, you know, set the vision and clarify that. I have to ensure that I have that in my calendar each week on certain days where I do that. And then much of the rest of it is really the bottom-up approach, I find very essential. And actually embracing more of that, more of David's approach, when I realize that the pile of, you know, mess around me or emails or whatnot, it is getting in the way and so forth. So for me, it's about having a system, having certain days where I have that energy to focus on clearing away the runway, and then having other days where I can focus on the vision, the 50,000 foot down. And so, you know, I have set days and set energy cycles on those days where I focus on these things, and that makes a difference for me.
Understandable. Yeah, David approaches the 30 to 50,000 foot level for this sort of six-level model for reviewing very hands-off. You know, as he explains in the book, quote, getting things done is more about the art of implementation than about how to define goals and vision, end quote. So I'm sort of curious from folks if they have any thoughts on where do you go to get those higher levels fleshed out in your life? And if you have recommendations for where people might want to go if they're just starting or to get some clarity on it all. Joseph had just mentioned Anthony Robbins as being one avenue for that. And I know that for myself, I started out from the Stephen Covey world. And so Dr. Stephen Covey's work in building mission and vision from not only the 7 habits of highly effective people, but then moving up to the 8th habit, which is finding your mission and vision and then helping others find theirs. And I think that's a really great place to start. I'm curious if folks have other places where they've found that sort of mission, vision, goals building method for themselves. Well, then I'm gonna move us into Chapter 10 then. And Chapter 10, David goes into explaining the plethora of techniques and tools for doing natural informal planning. And he says, quote, virtually all of us could be doing more planning and more often about our projects and our lives, end quote. I think this is true. One of the first stages he discusses is brainstorming. And actually, Joseph, I think, noted earlier something about mind mapping. And so how do you brainstorm? What tools, methods, and such do you use? So I'm sort of going to ask you, Joseph, what do you use to brainstorm currently? Which mind mapping tools, or do you do it on paper? Not paper isn't a tool. Paper is a tool, but what do you use for mind mapping?
Certainly. So I do combination of two things. So it really depends on if I want to be around technology or not. So if I'm around technology, I'll do mind maps. I use MindJet for the most part, and I just kind of expand mind map with ideas and resources, and I link things to the mind map. Then I also have a desk in my place. It's like an architect desk. There's no technology around it. There's nothing, no screens, none of that stuff. And sometimes it helps me to be in a place where there are no such distractions, where I'm able to clear my mind completely. And then I'll do kind of a fluid mind map, pen and paper and markers, and I find that to be very extraordinary to be able to do that, particularly in the absence of technology. Those are the two things that I take on.
Great, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Anyone else with sort of mind mapping, brainstorming tools, project planning tools that you use? Mark?
Yes, sir. I've got something. I've actually experimented with a lot of mind mapping tools. Lucid Charts is one, and there are a lot of them out there, and they're really good. But I've actually found one thing I want to experiment with is the cool pen theory that David Allen talks about. But what I found in my life is that the tool is not as important as dedicated time focused towards a project, like 1 to 3 hours of me sitting down with, if I want to have a mind mapping tool, that's fine, or if I want to have a notebook paper or a word processor, that's fine, but just dedicating that time to that specific project is key. So I guess time over the tool.
And this is just about the time that I extol the virtues of this really, really fantastic YouTube video by John Cleese of Monty Python fame. He talks about creativity and its power in problem solving, and I believe it applies here with GTD in terms of project planning, certainly. And it just dovetails a lot with GTD in a lot of ways, because David talks about using the system in order to be able to have open, free, creative time. And so this YouTube video, I'll provide it in the show notes, but it is fantastic. It's about 40 minutes and I think 36 minutes, and it is entertainingly funny. John Cleese is, of course, just hilarious, and he also delivers this amazing understanding of what it means to create this open creative space that you talk about, Mark, in terms of making sure that you have time to do those things and you have this open space to be able to create and to problem solve and those other things. So I certainly agree. I definitely agree that it doesn't matter about the tool so much as it does that having that space, that time to be able to do those things. I, for one, use Mind 42. It's actually Mind 42, the number 4, the number 2, meaning that you're supposed to share and collaborate with the mind mapping tool. And I really like it. It's a much more structured mind map system, but you can attach almost anything to it, and it's web-based.
I've used that as well, and it's been around for a long time. It's collaborative as well, and you can share mind maps. And it's really great to hear you're still using that, because I've heard from reviews that there are other tools out there that are more modern, but that's the one that I used to use them both, so I'm going to get back on top of that.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where people tend to want to go for things with lots and lots of features and functions, but I sort of take the paradox of choice perspective on that, I think that a limited feature set with the features that I need is better than going after something. You know, like the personal brain, fantastic tool. I think it just has way too many options for me, and it, you know, obviously the price point also is sort of prohibitive for me to think that, you know, myself and every person who needs to use it has to pay $300 license in order to be able to use it, or whatever it is. I'm not sure what the license fee is, but it's, you know, it's an expensive tool, and that ends up being something that holds me back from wanting to maintain a tool like that. And something like Mind 42, where it works, it's collaborative, all I have to do is invite someone to that particular mind map. It can link to other mind maps. It can export into many different, you know, formats. It's great, and I can import from many different formats. It's fantastic, and you know,
brilliant,
great tool.
Yeah,
you
know. Thank you.
And there's free mind out there. There's so many others out there that are out there as well. And so I just wanted to sort of close up the conversation with just one last question for folks, which is the smartphone issue, which is, how do you think your smartphone, if you have one, has changed the very nature of getting things done now, 12 years since the first publication, as it relates to some of the tools that David Allen offers? I know that for me, it's fundamentally changed the nature of my work, and I'm curious about other people's experiences with that. I'm sort of curious to actually pick on you, Robert, because you work at home, and therefore you have all of this latitude to get all things done. You know, like if you have both your work and personal stuff sort of together. And I'm curious if a smartphone actually enhances or does anything different to your work life.
I would say it enhances it tremendously. Just the mobility factor, that if I am at home and I need to go out, I have my office with me. And that's tremendously powerful, and also relieves a lot of stress.
That totally makes sense. It's a good perspective to hear. I'm curious about other folks' thoughts in terms of their experiences with smartphone now. You know, you don't have, do people still use an at computer context when you can email from anywhere and you can make phone calls from anywhere? At calls doesn't seem to seem relevant to some people, although it seems very relevant to me. Albert, do you have any thoughts? I know that you're somewhat restricted sometimes in regard to what technology you have access to. And so do you still use, your smartphone more or less in some context?
No, I just use it less. I think I think most people would call me still having a dumb phone, but I guess I don't use any data.
you have a smartphone or you have a feature phone?
Well, no, I have a smartphone. It's just that I don't have I disabled my data on it because I really wasn't using it.
Oh, right. And you're primarily using in a lockdown environment with regard to your job, so you end up just not using the data.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you're at home, do you feel like you use the smartphone more in that environment?
Yeah, I do. Yes, I feel like, well, it also gives more distractions. So I guess locking it down helps me to basically concentrate and not like work on something that's not really very productive, like maybe posting on Facebook or something.
Right. I think I should probably take a bit of that advice, and it's a good piece of advice, which is to sometimes turn your phone into airplane mode or something like that. I believe in moving the phone out of your room once in a while, you know, the room in which you're working on something, so that you're not constantly bombarded by texts or phone calls or Facebook messages popping up and so forth. That's really great.
I take on Robert's as well, that feedback. I don't like being tethered to a device. I have a two-year-old Android that I have, and I'm looking at getting a Note 2, like a Samsung Note 2 sometime in the near future, but I'm also concerned about that because I don't want to be tethered to any device. What I do like is that because much of my world is on Google Apps, Google Voice, and so forth, I can be in front of any computer and work there, and I appreciate being in airplane mode and being disconnected from my mobile device as much as possible because it just allows me to bring that much more presence into the tasks, the projects, the relationships, and all those things that count, particularly in
yeah,
the
really,
before,
really,
the choice, the paradox of choice factor, having so many choices out there. And the smartphone now all of a sudden multiplies that choice factor by, you know, like 50-fold at times. So for me, it's untethering myself so I can minimize those choices.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that I'm hoping for is that somebody comes up with what BlackBerry has had for so many years, which is the profile concept, you know, where you can set all of your sort of alerts and so on and so forth based on a context. So I could have a running profile. I could have a movie profile. I could have a meeting profile, and it would automatically change all of my vibration, notification, and ringing volumes, all in one fell swoop that you can't do with any of the other smartphones today, and it really seems absurd that you can't do that. Anyway, Mark, with the final comment.
Echo the thoughts about the airplane mode. I kind of find a lot of success when I restrict myself to certain what I might call stimulating activities, like going onto Facebook, something where I'm not really getting any benefit from doing that, and so I kind of turn off all those notifications on my phone, and so I don't actually receive them. I actually choose when I want to do that. Kind of helpful.
That's really important from a control and perspective view.
Chet Holmes has a book called The Ultimate Sales Machine, and something he put down in one paragraph in that book, on the chapter 2 of that book, talks about time management. From his experience of working with, you know, executives, entrepreneurs, and so forth, is that when a person checks email or Facebook messages or something of that sort, or text message on a regular basis, how it affects their ability to prioritize. It creates like this whole syndrome. I forget the name of the syndrome. He talks about it, but the way he verbalizes it or writes it out just had me see the impact of that, such that I'm getting into a habit of now checking my email like 3-4 times a day and limiting to that and honoring that. And I know, Ray, we talked about that at a prior meeting of that sort. And you know, Michael Gerber says this too, that the most valuable skill that an entrepreneur can maintain and grow and expand is that ability to concentrate, to focus on one thing continually for an extended period of time, and build on that.
That is very, very true. And I'll end this series of chapters 7 through 10 with a David Allen quote, which is, quote, clear the deck, create a context, and do some creative project thinking. You'll then be way ahead of most people, end quote. So thanks, everybody, for the discussion regarding getting things done. And we're just a couple of announcements before we wrap up. First, our next productivity book group call will take place on April 13th at noon Eastern Standard Time. And so that will probably be the last one where we do this at noon Eastern Standard Time. We'll have a discussion about when to reschedule the next series of calls to make it most convenient for everyone. And so again, April 13th at noon Eastern Standard Time, I'm sorry, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, we'll cover part 3, The Power of Key Principles. That's chapters 11 through 13 and the conclusion to getting things done. I'll shed a tear before we move on to other books. And all the information about Productivity Book Group is posted to productivitybookgroup.org. Again, that's productivitybookgroup.org. The podcasts are archived there under episodes. I hope you'll be able to join us for the live call on April 13th or subscribe in iTunes or elsewhere to listen to the archives. And feel free to, and please, review the podcast in iTunes. It really helps to get Productivity Book Group's exposure in the Apple iTunes network. So thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, guys.